Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Somebody please think of the children.
And welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
And I'm Mary Beth.
In each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, our guest is Anthony Cousins, director of short films such as When Susurrus Stirs and Every Time We Meet for Ice Cream, Your Whole Fucking Face Explodes, segments in Scare Package 1 and 2, and the upcoming found footage film Frogman that I haven't shut the fuck up about for a while. Welcome to the show!
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
I was telling Terry, I did not realize that you directed When Susurrus Stirs, and I was so excited because I watched that years ago and was like, that's fucking gross, and I love it. And then I was like, holy shit, wait, that's Anthony Cousins, whoa! And so that's really cool, and I had to include it in the intro, because hell yeah. So you've been making gross stuff for a while.
Yeah, for a bit now. Mm-hmm. I like gross.
Hell yeah.
Me too.
Me too. Yeah. But before we talk about how you got into the gross, can you, for our listeners who maybe haven't heard me talk about this movie nonstop, can you tell them a little bit about what Frogman is?
Oh, sure. Well, Frogman is your favorite cryptid that you didn't know existed yet, because you probably know Mothman and Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster, and they're all awesome, but, you know, they're like the cool kids. And Frogman's like the angry emo kid that secretly you think is the coolest kid in school, but you can't admit it. But you know what? Now you can. I want to make it okay to love Frogman as much as I do, because he's a real legend in Loveland, Ohio. He's been seen in the woods with a wand, a magical wand, by multiple people, which I don't understand. Either it's like mass hysteria, or he's really out there, and he's got a wand.
But I'm like, pray. That there's a wizard frog in the woods of Ohio. That is all.
Right?
Who
doesn't want that? I mean, Bigfoot is very plausible, you know, or it's at least like very plausible why someone would mistake, you know, a hiker or a bear or something as Bigfoot. You know, giant creatures in the sea, very plausible. I don't know how you accidentally see a 4-foot bipedal frog with a wand shooting sparks. I don't know how you make that up. So I think he's out there, and I decided to make a movie about him.
Are you from Ohio, or did you just learn it? Like, how did you learn about the Frogman?
I'm from Minneapolis, and that's where we shot, was in Minnesota.
Okay.
My buddy, John Carsco, who also co-wrote the script with me, he directs also. And we were making a short film, his, that took place at like a coast-to-coast style radio station. And like for the art direction, he bought like a map of the U.S. with like a cryptid in each state. And that's where I learned about Frogman, was he was representing Ohio. And we just started like researching him while we were on set. And we're just fascinated.
Yeah, it's wild. I didn't know until your movie that this was a real thing. And then I had like dove deep into it. And there's apparently a festival, like they do a Frogman festival now.
So, okay. So this is so funny because the DP on my feature, my upcoming feature, sorry, everybody, I'm going to be annoying about this forever. He wore, on one of the days of shooting, wore a Frogman shirt. And I'm like, is that a Frogman? And it was before I saw your fucking movie. So I was like, is that a Frogman shirt? He's like, oh my God, yes, I love the Loveland Frogman. I've been to the festival. I'm like, he's such a cool underrated cryptid. And then your movie happens, and I texted him immediately, and I said, Chance, our dreams have come true. There's a Loveland Frog movie, and not like a jokey movie. It's like, actually really, it's like a good movie. And he's like, I'm so excited. So just know that there were two people you really made very happy with this movie.
That's so awesome. You know, my like guiding force, my whole filmmaking career has just been making movies that I want to see. You know, no one was asking for adolescent love story where a little girl's face explodes, and no one was asking for a Loveland Frogman movie. But like, I wanted to see those. So, you know, I make these things and then I go, oh shit, does anyone else want to see this? Is anyone going to care? And it's just like kind of nerve wracking. And I think I've made a big mistake. So it is such a relief that there's other people that are excited about this.
Well, because Terry and I talked about this, there are not enough creature feature found footage movies. And like, I know with budget, it can be really hard to do creature features. Like, I get it. But it is also just so exciting to have a good weird monster movie in found footage format, because as most people know, I'm a found footage freak, and I'm making Terry a found footage freak, but we're both also monster movie people.
I'm a creature feature fan, like to the nth degree. And so I was like, I saw this and I was really excited about it because you have practical effects in here. And I'm curious what it was like kind of designing this frog creature and how you guys went about kind of creating it for the found footage film.
Yeah, you know what? I had the same thought, like, why aren't there more found footage creature features? And I'm guessing it's because it's really, really hard to do.
I was wondering.
You know, like, what you want to do when you make a found footage movie. And by the way, this is my first time ever trying found footage. So, like, and I'll say, when you try found footage for the first time, I don't care if you have a decade of traditional filmmaking behind, you know, in your roster like I did, it does not help. Like maybe you've learned how to problem solve really well, but nothing you learned about movie making helps when you make a found footage movie. It's like a whole new set of rules. And I know practical effects pretty well and how to shoot them. But when you're doing found footage and you're going for authenticity and you're, you know, you have to hold, you know, you like, or zoom in, like you can't cut, you can't get like, you can't get too cutty with it without losing the effect of found footage. It's really tough because then you're just staring at the practical effect and it starts to fall apart.
Yeah. And so that's what, I guess that's what surprised me about this is I was afraid, like a lot of times when we see practical effects, like you get quick shots of it or, you know, there's ways to cut around it. But when you are doing, as you said, found footage and you have to focus on that, you have to like be very confident in your creation. And I loved how naturalistic this creature felt in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, that was super important to us. I mean, I had a plan, like the chase scene, I wanted to be way crazier. Like I wanted the camera to like whip behind and like see this frogman like jumping towards him and then like up in the trees. And I just couldn't figure out this time around how to do that. Maybe on the next one we can plan ahead. But like, and the person in the suit was completely blind. So like all we could do was like put them where we wanted them. And like on set, it's not scary at all because like I just know it's just like like this blind person that has no idea where I'm at. So I'm like, oh my God. Oh, and then I whip to look at them and then whip away. And like they have no idea what just happened. Like they're just standing there. And a couple of times I like gave them a path. I'm like, I promise if you take like 5 to 10 steps, you're okay if you go this direction. You know, so we could get a
trust
little
exercises.
Bit of, yeah, right. So it was interesting. And the suit was pretty, it was hard to move around into. But I think it turned out okay. I think it looks pretty cool.
It looks great. It really does.
I was very curious how you were going. Well, because I feel like with cryptids and found footage, you can very easily get cheesy. And I was like, how are they going to pull off a frogman? And I was incredibly impressed. I was like, actually, this is disgusting. I love that. But it's so easy to go cheesy with, like, that kind of concept. So.
For sure.
It's nice
and you know
to
what?
Not see it go cheesy.
There's scenes on the cutting room floor that bring this movie into more of a trauma world.
Okay.
Yeah. And yeah, I was worried. I was like, you know, the intention was, let's make a movie about the Loveland Frogman, which is in and of itself going to be funny. You know, yeah, like, right. It's naturally just going to be funny if you make a movie about that. But everyone within the movie has to take this completely seriously. You know, it would not be funny to you if your life was in danger because you were getting chased by this frog monster. But to me, it's hilarious. So it was like, it was a fine line to try and walk. And there was stuff that just went too far into like Tromaville, which I love. That's just not what we were trying to do here.
Fair. That's fair.
I mean, I also just loved how horny the movie was in that regard without like crossing over completely. Cause like, I could also see in some of those moments, it going completely Troma with that. Like, that's immediately what I was thinking of when you were talking about that. But I do love that this movie is horny and asks the important questions of whether Frogman fucks.
Does Frogman fuck?
Yeah. Which I can't. I don't know how we didn't see like that becoming the thing when we wrote that, but I'm so glad it did, because yeah, it seems like movies are just getting hornier again in general, which I love.
Thank God. We have Thank gone God. Through a drought, and we can just stand to have a little bit hornier movies, even ones right. with frogmen.
I agree.
And especially ones with frogmen.
Isolation kind of made everyone's horniness come to the rise to the
yeah,
top.
Yeah, that's again. A good point. That's a real good point. So I do want to ask really quick about When Sorcerer Stirs, only because I have, like, my own personal relationship with that movie. Why was that, like, that's your first directing credit on IMDb. So why that as your first foray into directing, of all things?
Well, like every young aspiring filmmaker, I went to film school wanting to be a director. And then, you know, when you're in there, you realize, like, what you're maybe good at, and you're, you know, but everyone goes in wanting to be a director.
Yeah.
And my first year, I realized, oh, I'm pretty good at cinematography. And like, people started asking me to shoot their things. And there was like way more charismatic people that wanted to be directors and wanted to do horror stuff. So I was like, oh, I should just team up with them. And I'll be the cinematographer. That works. And I also wrote a little bit too. And then I read the short story When Sorcerer Stirs, and I was completely obsessed. And I was like, I need this to exist, and I want to shoot it so bad. And I went to a couple of friends, and nobody wanted to direct it. Like, no one wanted to touch it. And I was like, oh, no, what? Like, I want this. I want to shoot this so bad. So that's when I decided, I guess I'll direct this one. And honestly, I thought it was going to be like a one-off. Like, I'm just directing this because no one else will, and I just really want to shoot it. And then to my surprise, it did really well and turned out pretty good. So I freaked out, and I thought I peaked, and I thought I'll never make anything that cool again. And then I made a second thing, and that did pretty well. And so that's why I'm here now, because I guess I'll just keep making things until, I'm proven otherwise.
Hell yeah. I love that. I wanted to do it. So now I made a movie about Frogman.
Yeah.
And now Here we are. Hell yeah. I love that. But I want to know how did you get introduced to the horror genre? Like, what is your relationship to it as a child? What was it like as a child when you were younger?
Man, I'm really fortunate where like my parents were so supportive of my obsession with horror and Halloween that like, it goes so far back, I don't even know. Because I think, like, my mom especially, like, realized really early on, like, oh, he's leaning dark. Like, he's leaning towards the weird shit. And she just fed into that. I mean, my mom showed me, like, so many things way before I probably should have seen them. Like, I've watched American Werewolf in London with her. Like, I mean, Gremlins was a staple of my childhood. Tales from the Crypt. My grandma had HBO, like I would watch Tales from the Crypt in her kitchen. That's another childhood trauma. Oh my God, the Don Rickles episode with the puppet that like fuses to his hand. I'll never forget that.
Oh my gosh.
So yeah, it started really, really young. I just always loved the creepy shit. I mean, even in, you know, movies that weren't inherently creepy, I loved the creepy aspects of them. And I always loved the villains, you know, like I always dreamed that like a horrible accident would scar me across my eye so I look like Scar from The Lion King. Like, I just thought he was so cool. So yeah, it's been so long.
Cool.
Your shorts and your film all kind of toe the line between horror and comedy. Was that like a genre that you were interested in as a kid, or how did that kind of come together between the horror and the comedy?
I guess it's just panned out that way so far.
Okay.
I mean, like even Susurrus, which I think is like probably the most serious thing I've done, is still has some comedy in it, because again, it's just like, it's such an absurd concept that I was like, we can't take this too seriously. And I mean, one of my favorite directors of all time is David Cronenberg, who I think has a very similar approach where like, he seems so serious. You look at him and you're like, this is the most serious man on the planet, you know? And then you like hear him talk and he's like nothing but quips and like this dry humor. And he makes these very like profound, haunting movies. And yet there's just bits of comedy woven into all of them. And then it's just kind of panned out that way since then. Like I did a short called The Bloody Ballad of Squirt Reynolds.
We were laughing about that earlier because I love the name. It's just such a good name.
Yeah. And Paper Street Pictures saw that and they asked me to come on to Scare Package. So that's how I did more horror comedy than I ever intended to.
Cool.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just that they go really well together.
They do.
I mean, I definitely have a couple ideas that are way more serious, like maybe a little more A24-y, but I just haven't been able to do them yet.
So what did you kind of gravitate to as a kid in terms of horror? Because it sounds like you were given a buffet of horror films to watch and horror TV to watch as a kid. Mm-hmm. Was there a specific kind of subgenre or a specific kind of film that you found yourself gravitating to more?
Body horror for sure.
Okay.
That, I mean, nothing messes me up like body horror in the best way. Like, I could watch The Fly any day of the week. And just...
Perfect film.
A perfect film, yeah. And the image of, like, who Seth Brundle is at the beginning of the movie versus this creature that, like, doesn't even resemble a human anymore by the end. Like, yeah. I just love that journey. It's so fascinating to me. And American Werewolf in London, too. Like, oh, you know, it starts with just, like, this cute little young backpacker boy, and then it ends with a werewolf dead in the middle of Piccadilly Circus. Like, I just love, like, those journeys where just, like, someone, like, loses their humanity. I think that's, like, so fascinating.
So that kind of explains the relationship between, like, the gross stuff that you put on, like, that you film. And I'm curious, like, what has it been like then to be able to make that kind of body horror? Like, that's got to be so cool to go from loving it for so long and then being able to create these practical body horror effects. Like, that's just so cool.
It's so much fun. I mean, there's nothing else I would ever want to do. Like, and practical effects, you know, I think they're more fun to watch, but absolutely, selfishly, they are so much more fun to, like, play with. You know, like, if we shot a movie called Frogman and it was a completely CGI character, so we never had a Frogman on set, like, yeah, that'd be so unsatisfying of an experience.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be there with them, you know?
I want to be able to feel the Frogman.
You had an experience with a lot of horror film as a kid. Were you a scared kid watching them, or how did you handle all of those different horror films as a kid?
Things unsettled me for sure.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that I scared easily from movies, at least. I was terrified of the dark, and like, I still run up the stairs as fast as humanly possible. It's just like muscle memory at this point. But as far as movies, they didn't scare, like, there's a couple that really scared me to the point that I had to leave the room. But mostly they just unsettled me. Like, they just stick with me.
Okay.
Well, I know we're obviously talking about one that really got you, but can you tell us some other ones that, like, got you, and, like, ones that got you to leave the room in the middle of them?
Yeah. Okay. So anything with, like, a creepy old woman would get me. So, like, the holy trinity of, like, getting me to leave the room is Pet Sematary with Zelda.
Yeah.
I even remember, like, And this is the thing, like, so few movies could do that to me that it became, like, even when I was young, a challenge where I'm like, I'm gonna fucking get through this time. And I remember, like, Pet Sematary was one of those movies that would be on, like, cable all the time. And it came on in the middle of the day on, like, a summer weekday one time. And so I'm watching it in, like, my living room, and it's just bathed in sunlight. And I'm like, I'm fine. I'm totally fine. I'm going to make it through this. And then Zelda came on, and I bolted for, like, the door. And I, like, watched the scene through the patio door. That's, like, that's the best I could do at the time. But also the miniseries, especially when the woman, I don't know, like, Bev is like visiting some old woman, and then she turns into this, like, haggard, like, creature and starts like saying the lines of Bev's dad. That like chilled me so bad. And then the bathtub lady from The Shining.
Yeah. Oh, that was the first one that came into my head when you were talking about that. It's like The Shining has to be on there, because that sequence would be horrifying. It is the epitome of the kind of creepy old woman.
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever get over, like, if I go into a bathroom and, like, the bathroom, like, the tub sheet is up. What the hell is that thing called? A shower curtain? If that thing is, like, if that thing is closed, I open it. That's the first thing I do if I go into a bathroom.
Me too. Because
she's in there otherwise.
Not because of her, but yeah, no, I got it. But I got the sentiment of being like, nope. Yeah. Why old ladies? Like, why? Let's dig into it.
What is it? I don't know.
That's so funny.
I really don't know. I should meditate on that.
Does that continue to today? Or have you overcome that fear?
I mean, I can sit through those movies now and get through those scenes, but there is a little boy in me that still wants to bolt. But I can sit there.
Do you still get scared watching movies now?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
cool.
Like, the Grudge, love it or hate it, like, that ghost freaks me the fuck out every time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Same.
It's a good one.
And, like, Paranormal Activity, how old? Like, I was probably, like, 15 or something when Paranormal Activity came out. I don't remember. But, like, I remember watching it, enjoying it, being like, that wasn't that scary. Like, you know, I had heard all the hype, and I was like, eh. And then I went home and I was horrified. Yep. Absolutely horrified. Like, that movie follows you home.
It does. So I watched it through less than legal means on my laptop, because none of my friends would go see it, and none of my, like, no one would take me. And I was just like, fuck y'all. And I watched it at home in the dark. I was like, oh, I'm such a badass. And I slept with the lights on in my room for 2 weeks. I was like, fuck this. This is terrifying. I'm going to get possessed by a demon. So I get that, because that movie stuck with me for a long time.
It's so effective. And I think it's like, when you're watching it, the fact that you don't see anything is what, like, makes it maybe not as impactful as an experience as, like, when the movie's over and you're alone at home, or it's like night and it's dark, because, like, then everything you experience and absorb during the movie is now, like, in the room with you. It feels like
horrifying.
Spooky. Anyway, do you remember the last movie that truly scared you?
Truly scared me. Damn, I don't know. I mean, things like, you know what? Terrified. That was the last movie that truly scared me.
That Drink movie listeners. Me the fuck out. That one comes up a lot.
Because it's really fucking scary. Like, it's
absolutely.
There's a reason why.
So many moments. That dude under the bed. Like, even that opening scene where you're just, like, hearing the pounding, and then it's like I'm chilled right now thinking about that reveal of, like, what is making that noise.
Yeah.
Have you seen his new movie, When Evil Lurks?
Yes.
Okay, good.
So good. Yes.
So good.
And he's, like, the nicest guy too. I met him once, and I was like, so many terrible things live in that brain, and you are such a nice man. I love horror filmmakers, because the creepier your movies, the nicer you typically are as a person, which I find so funny.
Oh, that's so good to hear. Yeah, I don't know what that, you know, we're expelling our demons, you know, so that we're not carrying them around with us, hopefully.
That's a very good point. Okay, Anthony, we have talked to you about your films. and your childhood horror experiences, but what movie did you bring with you today for us to discuss?
I brought The Dark Crystal.
The Dark Crystal. So listeners, this was one of the first films we covered many, many years ago, and we are now revisiting it again because we have not talked about this since before all of our format changes, so this is very exciting. But if you do not know what The Dark Crystal is all about, on another planet in the distant past, a Gelfling embarks on a quest to find the missing shard of a magical crystal to restore order to his world.
All right. So take us back, Anthony. How old were you when you saw this? How did you see this? What about this movie terrified you? Give us your horror story.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, like my parents were so supportive of the creepy stuff that I loved that I don't even know, like, at what point. It must have been my older siblings probably had the VHS tape. Okay. And I inherited it. And I still have it. And it's, like, one of my favorites because it's in this, like, green clamshell. It's so beautiful with, like, this purple, picture. But so I had the VHS tape. And I don't know at what age I started watching it, but it was very, very young. And it was a frequent watch for me, because like I said, like I would get unsettled by these kind of movies, but I loved that feeling, and few movies did it as well as this one. This movie just, it almost feels at times to me, even when I watch it now, like a documentary. Like this world is like so well fleshed out and these creatures are so realistic, and like it opens with this like very subdued, like male voice, kind of like setting the stage for you. And it just like, it feels like you're watching Animal Planet or something.
It does. You're absolutely right.
Really
I hadn't even
does.
Thought about that until just now. But it has that sort of like that quality that you are getting a peek into this other world, just like in a nature documentary.
Yeah. And all the, you know, it really takes its time in a beautiful way to like just focus on the nature too. You know, there's mm-hmm. long moments where it's just kind of like going across the landscape and it's like showing you some sort of critter like running by, you know, flowers, and then the flower eats it, or, you know, like something like mm-hmm. that. It's the world that they built is unbelievable. And I don't think there's ever been anything like it before or after.
No, it is definitely on its own in the way that it creates this world and then gives it so much life. Every single time I watch this, I'm blown away by how it looks and how much little details there are in the background that I miss and I will catch on a new viewing every single time, because it's just full of life in a way that seems antithetical to the fact that it's all just puppets, but yet it feels so fucking real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and like that is something I think I'm so surprised at, how every time I watch a Jim Henson film, I'm always in awe of the artistry in these. Like, we don't have anything like this anymore, not to like be that person, but like this is just a special era of like specifically like children's filmmaking, I think. And I was kind of talking about this with Terry a little bit, because these are movies that are like meant for teenagers, kids, but they're taking it like the topic so seriously through these like puppets, but they're not making it like haha funny puppets, but like showing you what art can be in such a different way. And it's so cool to see that and to see how much of that we got to grow up with, I think. Like, I don't think I ever really appreciated how cool the stuff I got to watch as a kid was until I'm seeing maybe what my nieces and nephews are watching. And I'm like, God damn it, they don't make it like they used to. And it's just, it's so wild how much creativity there is in these worlds. Like, who the fuck just creates an entire world with like these weird vulture creatures and urus and gelflings? Like, it's just so amazing that something like this exists, so that's like so complex but also like so well rendered.
Yeah. And there's like there's a few other movies I'd put in that category, like The Labyrinth, Neverending Story, even Beetlejuice. Like every time I watch Beetlejuice, I am just in awe of the sets they built and like the lengths they went to like make this like the afterlife feel like a fleshed out real world, you know, like when you get a glimpse of like that office he goes into, like I'm just like every time scouring the frame, I'm like, oh my God, I just want to understand everything.
So many details.
But
I don't think anything does it on this scale where it's like,
no,
I mean, they built an entire fucking world and and like every single thing besides, I think there's like a couple like really like vast, like wide shots, like almost like Lord of the Rings style journey shots. Mm-hmm. And besides that, 99.9% of this movie, everything in frame was handmade. And like, that just blows my mind.
Mine too.
I think there's only probably like one other movie you can watch where it's like exclusively puppets. Like there's not a human in the entire thing, which I think is another thing that it like makes this feel so real and believable in a way that you don't get even when you watch like a CG movie, because you're like, you're watching animation, but this, you are watching something that's real, you know?
Mm-hmm. So take us back. What about, you were very young when you saw this. What was your kind of, do you remember your experience watching this for the first time? Or what about it like really just stuck out at you and terrified you?
Man, there's like endless moments to pinpoint, but like starting from the beginning, the emperor scene, like where this, or I think he's called an emperor, but like, you know, this rickety ass like vulture creature that's like laying in bed, holding on to his like scepter and his power for dear life, and these other guys are just like waiting for him to croak so that they can, you know, like fight over who gets to take over next. But like, he is so fucking scary looking. Like, it's just nasty. Like, he looks cancerous. And then he just starts to, like, fall apart. Like, he just, like, crumbles like he's sand or something. I mean, that is just a haunting image.
When this is the image that I think has stuck with me the entire time, because I had not seen this movie again until we recorded back in, gosh, it must have been 2019 when we talked about it. And we had done like a double feature with two directors. And so it like, we only spent a very little time, but watching this then and then watching this now, this scene is the one that just sticks in my mind the entire time. And watching it this time kind of unlocked a memory that I didn't even know I had, of thinking as a kid about watching this old, I mean, he's basically just bones and feathers at this point, and he's just like, he's like just cawing at people and doesn't want to let go of this, of his scepter. And then he starts to, as you said, fall apart. And that moment for me, I think now that I'm thinking about it, might be my first like encounter with death, and thinking that this is like decay and this thing just kind of crumbling in front of you. Horrifying.
Yeah.
Horrifying. Totally.
Wow. And there's a couple moments that kind of make you face things that, you know, you know what? Maybe we should face as kids. We turned out okay, right? But like, like when I think about what we should expose kids to, there's quite a few moments in this movie that I'm like, I don't know, man. Like the podling getting the essence sucked out of it. I mean, that is another, just like, there is so much like fever dream nightmare imagery in this movie. Like that thing, like when its eyes go like blank, and then it's like its skin and its hands and its face start like withering and getting skinnier. Oh my God.
Yeah. And then there's the device that's dripping his essence into a vial to be drink. It's like nightmare fuel.
It's so interesting to see like the kinds of things that creators, studios, whatever, were like, kids can handle that. You know, like it's just very fascinating to see, because we've talked about so many movies like this and like movies that have had like a profound effect on all of us, but were also like kind of terrifying. But because I think they took their audiences a little bit more seriously in terms of like understanding the themes and like kind of not being afraid to be afraid. And I just don't, it's cool that people would like, I don't know how to put this, like take kids a little bit more seriously in terms of understanding that. And I know to a point it's like, but we also were all fucked up, but also like, I don't know. I would rather watch this than other things I see out now. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Like, even if it is absolutely terrifying, like the Skeksis, there's like the rock fight when That's the one that will fuck me up forever, is them all just beating each other to death with rocks. Like, well, you know what? It's like, oh my God.
Yeah. And like when they like strip Chamberlain yes! of all his like robes, like, I don't know. There's just, there's these moments that haunt me that are almost hard to like pinpoint what it is about it. Like that, I don't know, is like just seeing that type of like savagery as a child, or like, you know, lack of, I mean, clearly they're not human, but you know, they're intelligent and they're speaking. So, you know, you'd think that they could care for each other, but instead they're just like, fuck you. We're going to like just strip you of all your clothes and exile you. And it's just like, and they're so big. Like when they're in their clothes, they're just like really yeah. large. They're like turkeys. And then when you take all their clothes off, they're like barely being held together. They're so frail, which is like kind of a haunting image too.
It really is. And that is another, that's the other sequence that, there's three or four sequences in this movie that, have just been seared into my head. And that is the other one where, you know, as a kid, I'm thinking you see them as very bulky and you just assume that that's their body, right? I didn't think of it as being like that they're under, that they have weird clothing underneath them or whatever, that they are actually just this big creature. And I didn't even think about it as clothing for them, because it all seemed very like part of themselves. And yeah. so then when they're ripping off and you realize that it's clothes and you see the sort of like weird, very small body that is just like a plucked chicken by the end of it. It's that scene of him sort of like, he's been violated and he's up against the wall and he is like, don't look at me, almost like kind of covering himself, is very powerful and very like terrifying. And I think that's why that image has just been seared into my head for 30 odd years.
Totally. And like just the character design of pretty much every creature in this movie is like the Landstriders. Here's a creature yeah. that is on the good side. Like, you know, they're part of the hero team, and yet they are horrifying looking.
They are.
Like, they have these like fishy, like these creepy fish eyes. They have like ground beef tentacles hanging from their mouths. They have like these giant bat ears, but they're coming out of their shoulder blades. Like, I mean, I don't even know like where you come up with that, but it is so striking. It's just another thing that makes this feel almost like documentary like to me. You know, where we're like seeing these real creatures from another planet. And then when the like the Garthum like take one down and eat it, like, oh, and then the one goes off the cliff, like, oh man, those moments are just, yeah, I feel like I'm watching like a gazelle get taken down.
Yeah.
And again, because it feels real, because it's an actual puppet and you're like, oh, this is a real creature that I can go hang out with and touch. And then it's just, it makes it again feel more lived in, more like tactile. And actually watching this reminded me of a show I just finished called Scavenger's Reign on Max, on HBO Max. Mm-hmm. It's not at all the same story, and it's animated, but it's that idea of like living in this world and feeling like you're like discovering these completely alien creatures as if we should all know what they are. And seeing the artistic freedom of artists being able to create just weird shit. Like the whole show feels like this, and that they were just like, have some fun, draw whatever you want and see what happens. And it's just so gorgeous. And this just reminds me of that. And it feels like people were like, here, just go nuts and design the weirdest thing you can think of. And then they made it. And it's just really cool to see that.
Totally. I love that show so much. That's like probably my favorite thing from last year.
I just finished it. It's so good.
It's so good. It just, I could watch that shit all day. I don't even care if there's a story. Like, just watching humans like realize or like figure out the utility of all these creatures and these plants. Like, that's the amazing thing about that show. Is like picking up a frog and it inflates and has helium in it, so you can like use it as a balloon to escape a cave. Like, shit like that. It's just so cool.
So cool.
Yeah. I want to talk about Agra, because she is the other thing that has like been in my head since I was a kid. And it's the introduction where Jen is like kind of climbing across this mountain and gets caught in these vines that like lift him up. And our first introduction to Agra is the little eyeball that she is holding, and she puts it up to look at him. And that is a moment that I think about all the fucking time. Love it.
It's so freaky. She is she's one of the greatest characters ever, maybe. Yeah. And just so real and fascinating. Like the noises she makes, the attitude she has.
Yeah. Like, I want to be here when I grow up.
Totally. That is the best you could hope for when you get to that age. She's a little Yoda-esque.
Yes. It's also like watching this. I didn't actually watch The Dark Crystal until I was an adult, but it's really, I always say it's interesting, but like, it is interesting to see how these, like, this is like the hero's journey. We know the hero's journey. Like, we know the arc. And it's interesting, and we know, like, the old crone character. And I think about just how Agra is, like, an incredible old crone character who, like, looks like an old crone, but is, like, the baddest bitch in all the land. And I love it when movies like this can kind of take, especially, like, in a world of, like, Disney movies and the tropes we're used to seeing in the hero's journey and, like, the old witch character who's, like, wise but annoying. I just love seeing how that's interpreted here with her as being more of a badass and less of the, like... And again, these are not humans. I am assigning, like, gender shit and, like, all that stuff to, like, non-whatever. Because I think on her Wikipedia page it even says, like, intersex, which is interesting in terms of saying, like, she doesn't actually have a gender. Anyway... That's going in a whole other direction. But anyway, also, did you know that Frank Oz portrays Agra?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the puppeteer behind her, which is great. Between what's that?
They do. She does have the same, essence as Yoda in that respect.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true.
Oh, that's right.
It's true.
I think she was originally supposed to be a male character. And later in the game, they gender swapped her and like reworked her, but you're right. She is like the ultimate old crone, and she is such a badass. Like when the Skeksis kidnap her and like, you know, she's facing all of them down in their chamber. She's just like, I'm not fucking afraid of you. Like, I'm just going to like pop a
squat and yelling at them and just like sits cross-legged on the floor. She's like, she curses them out basically, and then
moldy mildew, mother of muck, yes. Dangling, strangling, death. Like,
it's so good. Yeah, she just goes off. And she is like, she's also kind of like in the, you know, not necessarily like picking a side either. Like, I get the, you know, she wants probably the best for this world. But she is kind of like neutral a little bit.
And there's a little bit of cynicism in her too. Like, she's like, when Jen comes up to her and he's like, oh, you don't know what the crystal is, you don't know this, you don't know that, he's like, it's almost like, well, we're fucked. Like, meanwhile, here is this like gorgeous construction of the universe that is moving, which is another phenomenal piece of practical effect. It's so good. But I did want to say that I think the other reason that Agra works so well is voiced by Mrs. Baylock from The Omen. Like, Billy Whitelaw is the voice of Agra.
Oh, that's right.
So
that's
good.
Crazy.
It's a little bit of a horror reference being used here. And I loved when kid shows or kid movies did this. Like, there was like a whole thing in like the 80s where a lot of times they would hire a horror director to come in and do a kid's thing, and it still felt really adult. And so here is this actress that is, you know, horrifying in The Omen and is now voicing in a kid's movie. Like, just it's perfect.
Yeah. So damn, good. That's wild. And that, yeah, her set, I forgot, her set is just unreal what they created, and just like fully functional. Like, it's like it's a pretty thrilling scene where when the Gartham like infiltrate, that also kind of messed me up. Like, it like broke my heart to see her place get trashed by those creepy motherfuckers. But like, it's a pretty thrilling scene when Jen like grabs on to that, whatever, that pinwheel thing of the universe and like escapes through it.
Yeah.
Well, I do have to say, And I think I talked about this a while ago, but the scariest thing about the Dark Crystal to me are the Gelflings.
Fair.
That is quite fair. I was thinking this too on this watch. Like, they are unnerving.
Like, and this is the problem, I think, is because they look the most like people, and they are trying to make them look like people, and so it's very uncanny when they, like, their eyes don't have that, like, movement, and their fingers move kind of funny when he's playing the flute, and it's just that humanity to it just makes it very uncanny and makes them even scarier to be than the Skeksis. I'm sorry, but their eyes look kind of dead, and just something about their little bodies make me uncomfortable, like deeply uncomfortable. So
you nailed it. Like, they are the Gelflings are like maybe peak uncanny valley. And they also, they kind of remind me of like the old, I don't know who did it, but like, you know, like the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and like Santa Claus is Coming to Town, like those Christmas animations. Like, I get the same feeling, like the unnerving feeling of watching those characters move, the human characters.
I think the problem for me is that they look the most like puppets, because they look like they don't have a lot of texture on their skin. Like, it's just, it's very flat. It's very, it reminds me of like old school video games where like they didn't have the, you know, the resolution to like create skin texture. And so it was just sort of like flat areas of face. And that's what it kind of reminds me of. And it gives like this very, when you compare them to like the Urus, the Mystics, or like Agra, that have so much texture in their skin that makes them feel real, they don't feel of this world, which I guess makes sense because they think they're all wiped out, and so they think that, you know, that this is sort of like this mythical creation, so it kind of feels like they aren't part of the world in a bizarre way. But it also, to your point, Mary Beth, on this watch I found myself more unnerved by how textureless they were than any of the other creatures.
It's because you have a giant TV now, you can really see how creepy they look. Ah, I know they're supposed to be like Adam and Eve like characters, but I was like, throw them in a fire.
You know what? This world's better without the Gelflings. There's only two left. Wipe them out.
I didn't say it, but like, I did not say it either.
That's a really interesting point, though, that they feel not of this world, and they almost aren't. They are like the last two, which, to that point, the new, like the Netflix series, which I never finished because I loved it so much that I was like, I was trying to like savor it to the point that I just forgot to keep watching it. So I've seen like the first six episodes.
I'm glad you've seen it, because I haven't. And it's because like I was like very excited for it to come out. And then when I started seeing like the pre-release stuff, I was like, this looks so magical. I sort of, to the point that like I wanted to savor it so bad that I was like, I don't think I want to watch it. I don't want it, because I knew it was particularly afterwards that it was going to be the one season. It didn't get renewed. And I don't know if it's a complete story or not, but I was like, I want to watch it, but I also don't want to experience it and then it be over with. So it's sort of the same kind of feel. Was it good though, what you saw?
It was, yeah. And like, it's been, you know, God, it came out what, like 5 years, 6, 7 years ago now. Like, I do really want to finish. It's almost like keeping plastic over a, like a piece of furniture that you're trying to like not ever ruin because you love it so much. Like, that's how I feel about going back to that show. Like you said, it's just, we'll probably never get another Dark Crystal thing, you know, again. So like, I don't want it to end, but they did a really, really good job. But there are interesting updates. Like, it is slightly less creepy, but I think that's more so because it doesn't have like the lo-fi feel of this movie. You know, it feels modern. It still feels of the world. Like, they totally nailed like re-entering this world, but it's so slick. And like, even the Gelflings, like, they, you know, improved on the puppeteering of those creatures, and the designs were like, they're not as creepy anymore. It feels more Lord of the Ringsy. But yeah, I think that's another aspect that makes this movie so unnerving is how lo-fi it is.
It has that liminal space feeling. And I think that's just because of like the desaturation of some of the colors in certain moments and also the era of when it came out. It has like that very specific color palette too. That feels very like 70s and 80s fantasy is like, I associate it with like quite specifically like book faded fantasy book covers like that. So, and this has that color palette. And I don't think we can, I don't think many people are going to try that these days, but because it's that fantasy color, that like fantasy cover color palette, it just feels all the more like fantasy realm. And that might just be personally for me, but it just works for what this is and what it's trying to accomplish, yeah. I think, even more effectively.
No, you're right. Like, this movie feels more at home with, like, the like what is invoked in you when you see those epic fantasy novel covers from the 80s, more so than it's at home with any other movie that's ever been made.
Yeah, that's very true.
When I was watching it this time, and I was trying, because, like, the last time I watched it for the podcast, I was just all nostalgia. It was like, oh my gosh, this, because it had been so long since I had seen it. And it was funny how just the score brought me back immediately to being a kid. Like, it just transported me back to the first time I watched it. And so this time, because it's only been a few years, I was like, I'm going to try to think a little bit more critically about it. And I think the thing that jumped out at me is that this came out in 82, but like the sort of spirituality kind of angle of it reminded me of like the 70s with like the start of like the new age type thought process. And I did find this article. It was an interview with David O'Dell on Gizmodo. And I guess one of the things before we started to work on it, Jim Henson insisted that he read a book called Seth Speaks, which is this series of books called The Seth Material that a woman named Jane Roberts dictated to her husband in 63 until her death in 84. And it started with an experiment with a Ouija board, and they contacted some coherent messages from someone they called Seth, who was basically dictating all of this like very spiritual type stuff. And they created this whole book series about this kind of new agey religion that became like a cornerstone of the new age practice in the 70s. And so it's like this whole weird, like, think about reincarnations and different planes of existence and all of this stuff that kind of like when you watch The Dark Crystal, you can sort of see essence of it, like this idea of how the mystics are tied to the Skeksis and like this good and evil and how they can't survive with one another. And there's the spiritual beings by the end that they kind of turn into because they finally embrace themselves and become something greater because they accept all their holes. Like, there is some new age religion in the foundation of this, and it all goes back to this series of books, which I find so fascinating now as an adult reading this. And wow. Listeners, Mary Beth's face is so, what?
She's ready to deep dive.
Whoa, what the fuck? I just don't oh my God. What?
Yeah, I'd read the shit out of that.
She thought she was being spoken to by a ghost, and it became like a cornerstone of that is fucking what religion, everybody, is absolutely batshit crazy at all the time, and you can always trace it to somebody who thinks they can talk to ghosts. I think is really what religion is. Someone claiming they can speak to ghosts.
Pretty much.
I don't know why this is like blowing my mind in like a way that I'm just like, really? That is what the people. I haven't read it. Maybe it is quite deeply profound.
Sold millions of copies, apparently.
I mean, this feels like it could like spawn a Scientology style like church.
Look, I just watched Love Has Won, This Cult of Mother God, and she was convinced she was an alien that Robin Williams was going to pick her and come pick up because he was also an alien. So you know what? This is very much within the realm of possibility of someone being like, a ghost named Seth spoke to me and you must obey. And people are like, yeah, okay. Sorry. Unrelated to The Dark Crystal, but that's just wild to me.
Yeah. Because I stumbled down this rabbit hole is I was sitting here watching this and I kept thinking that it felt very 70s. It reminded me of like the Wizards or like just sort of like that era of fantasy. And yet it was coming out. I mean, it was early 80s. It was 82. But it felt like there was some adult type themes being explored here in terms of oneness and in terms of different selves and like that kind of aspect, which felt very 70s in its essence. And so that's sort of how I fell down this rabbit hole of discovering the Seth material, which I'd never heard of before. And I kind of want to check out the books because the Wikipedia page on the Seth material is wild. And the fact that sort of became one of the cornerstones of the New Age and then directly influenced The Dark Crystal and Jim Henson. Loved to give that book away to everyone.
You're saying is that ghosts are the reason we have The Dark Crystal.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, when you, you know, if you look up pictures of Jim Henson at the time of this movie, he absolutely looks like the kind of guy that would give you that book and think that everyone needs to read it. Uh-huh. And I kind of, maybe I trust him. I'm totally going to look into this.
Right?
I mean, I dig it. I just find it very funny.
But yeah, it's there's amazing. That thing of, you know, that like bringing like two become one or whatever, which you think is about, you know, fixing the crystal, bringing the final shard to make the crystal whole, which it is, but also, you know, plot twists like the or whatever they're called and the Skeksis fuse to be this new being. And it is like, it is very like New Agey, where the like one is just pure good, like almost too good. And the Skeksis are just the fucking worst. You know, they are like your shadow or whatever, you know, your unintegrated shadow. And then they become these like incredible, like beings of light. And those things are creepy and they don't feel good necessarily. They feel almost, I don't know, somewhere in the middle, which is what we are, right? Jim?
Right. Come on, Jim.
Jim. Speak to me, Jim.
Jim? Jim, speak through me. The Jim material. New Age, anyway.
I also did want to, we've talked about him a little bit, but I did want to bring up the is it the Garthan? Is that what they're called?
Yeah.
The little crabby creatures. Because another memory unlocked on this watch was the fact that I have terrible arachnophobia. I am terrified of spiders. And as I was watching this time, I don't know why all of a sudden these memories unlocked, but they reminded me of, I lived in Alaska when I first saw this, and we had real big orb. I think they're called orb weaver spiders, the very bulbous, little ugly
orb
creatures.
Weaver spiders?
they're called orb weaver.
Oh, weaver. Okay.
Yeah. Orb weaver spiders. Weaver. And they are like, they're very bulbous. And now as I was watching these creatures, I kept thinking about how they kind of reminded me in my childhood brain of the orb weaver spiders that I would see dangling. And the idea that these things could be that big and the way they move and how vicious they are. I mean, they're the most violent things in this movie. I mean, I guess you could kind of maybe say the Skeksis with when they're ripping out the clothes and stuff. But like they, for me, seem like the biggest threat because they're so large and they just don't give a fuck about walls or homes or anything. And so like I'm now remembering how terrified I was of orb weaver spiders because of this movie and vice versa. Like they're horrifying.
It goes too deep for you. I'm so sorry about that. The layers of arachnophobia that Terry has are so sad.
It's not, I'm like understanding my kind of like my the way my brain works now by watching these movies now as an adult that I saw as a kid between this and arachnophobia and all these films that I saw as a kid that are like inform my deep, 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 deep fear of spiders. It's just, it's wild to me. the layers. I'm with you, the dude. Onion.
I can't handle them. And I mean, like, if I'm scrolling on social media on my phone and a picture of a spider comes up, like, I will straight up throw my phone across the room.
Anthony, like, I cannot. We are arachnophobe soulmates, because that is, I literally, and I'm really afraid of my phone right now, because every single time I talk about spiders, TikTok will start thinking that, you want spiders? And so then I'll just get these videos, if I'm scrolling on TikTok, of spiders. And I have literally tossed my phone in shock because of what I show up. Because I can't even look at pictures of spiders, Anthony. Just like you said, I can't. I don't even want to see them.
No. They will come right through the phone and kill me.
They will.
I'm convinced.
Oh, they will materialize.
I've seen things that have changed me when it comes to spiders. Like, I don't know if I'll ever, as much as I love the outside and like camping and stuff, I don't think I could ever go camping in the desert. After this guy showed me, like, I was on set with this sound guy, and he was in California, and he had just gone camping, like, just outside of LA. I was like, oh my God, this sounds amazing. You're in the desert and like blah, 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 whatever, again, in touch with nature. And then he showed me a picture of these spiders that are like all over the fuck at night in the desert. I was like, I will never set foot anywhere near there.
I told this story the last time we talked on about arachnophobia, but one of my previous coworkers, he liked to camp, and he was talking about camping in the desert, and they would wake up and there would be these giant tarantulas charging them. And he said it's because they're cold. They're cold-blooded, and it's cold at night, and so they are running towards the warmth.
Yeah.
And fuck that shit. Absolutely. Go fuck yourself into the
no. Dude, I can't.
That's what this guy told me, is that these things will just like fucking bum rush you.
They will. No, because it's so cold at night, and they are cold, and they see warmth. And
if you're cold, warmth. They're cold. Let them in. Come on.
Nope. I don't think I'm
not even that scared of spiders, and I don't want that shit.
I could never mentally recover. Like, if something, like, you know, we've all had to deal with a spider from time to time, but if like a healthy sized spider ever touched me, I would just cease to be. Kill myself. I don't think I could ever go.
Like, I would just cease to be.
Go on.
As Mary Beth says, I would shit out my skeleton.
I would shit out my skeleton. I think the Gartham look like the Starship Trooper aliens.
Okay, they kind of do. You're right.
Yeah. The thing that messes me up about them, first of all, they did not have to make them that real looking. Like, they look.
No, what the fuck is that shit? They made them look like actual bugs. I'm like, you didn't do that for anything else?
They have like layers to their shell that when they move, the layers move. I'm like, holy, that is such an attention to detail that just makes this so much worse. And I think like one of the worst things about insects is insects that have so many like limbs that it almost seems like they have extras that they can't even use, you know, like a house centipede. And that's how the Gartham are. Like, the Gartham come out and they've got all these like tendrils hanging off of them. And they're just like, most of them are just like flailing and, you know, hanging limp. And I'm like, ugh. Yeah.
Why? Yeah, why?
They're bad.
That also reminds me, just the sound. I want to talk very briefly before we wrap up about the sound, because it's these sounds that also have stuck in my head this entire time. And the thing that I went back and looked at my notes that I had taken on the previous time when we were going to talk about this movie, and it's the same thing. It is the sounds that those creatures make, that sort of chitinous like sound. I remembered from when I was a kid, and that just like immediately took me back, because it is. The sound design and the creature noises in here, whether it's this or whether it's the Chamberlain's, like, just it seared in my head from a kid. And I it's amazing to me how sound can just immediately transport you back to where you were as a child, because this movie is like the epitome of sound for that, for me, between the music and the noises that they make.
Totally. And that, like almost like cicada like noise that the Gartha make, it's used a lot, and it's always effective. Like, it's used a lot in The Thing also, but it is just, it immediately kind of chills you to the bone for some reason and feels otherworldly. You know, it sounds like a sound from outer space.
It triggers like this weird fight or flight response, like a primal thing in your brain. Like, we have to get away from that, whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, it kind of sounds like a swarm, you know, which probably is a very primal, like, okay, there's a lot of something unknown coming towards me right now. Like, I should get out of here. Speaking of sound, though, did you guys know that, like, originally only the Gelflings spoke English?
No.
Oh.
Yeah. Really?
So they made the whole movie with every other creature speaking a completely alien language with no subtitles. So only the Gelflings speak English. And they screened it like that. And people were like, I have no idea what's happening. This is unintelligible. And so Jim and the screenwriter had to go back and watch the movie already completely edited and turned in and just write new lines that mostly fit like how the mouths were moving, which I think adds like another layer of like weirdness to this movie when you watch it.
Wow.
Holy shit, I did not know that.
I had no idea.
Wait, so no one like at any point was just like, hey y'all, not having subtitles for a completely alien language might make this really kind of complex fantasy story a fucking unintelligible.
I mean, this is the guy who swore by the life of Seth or whatever.
You know, you have such a good point there. You really do. So that's
fair. It all comes back to Seth.
They're probably on YouTube. There definitely is at least scenes of the Skeksis where you can watch it like with the original sound. But I really wish they've never released a whole cut of the movie like that. And I kind of wish they would because it'd be fun to
release the Skeksis cut.
The Skeksis cut. Yes. Come on, HBO Max.
Skeksis cut. Anyway.
That's a social media campaign I can get behind.
Hell yeah. All right. Do we want to wrap up and give this our rating out of 5?
That sounds good to me.
All right, Terry, you are up first. How many mmms out of 5 do you give The Dark Crystal?
Ah, man, this movie is perfect. I think you said it earlier, Anthony, where like there is no film before or after this movie that is like this film. And I think the fact that it does not have humans in it, like The Labyrinth does, or like the Muppets will sometimes have humans interacting with them. Like the fact that there is no humanity, it really does create this otherworldly, real world that doesn't take you out of it because you're just there and you're just experiencing it. And that to me is just amazing in a way that I don't think a lot of movies are brave enough to do. Like I keep thinking back about like maybe if they made this today, all of a sudden a human would crash land into the dark crystal world, and it would be because you got to have a human to like latch onto. Like I don't know. It just there's an assuredness to this film and such creativity to this film that I don't necessarily think that has been recreated, particularly for children's entertainment. This movie is singular in the existence of film, and every single time I watch it, it just brings me back to being a kid watching this for the first time. It's a 5 for me all around. What about you, Mary Beth?
I'm sorry, it just makes me laugh. So I don't have the nostalgia factor for this one as much, but I still really enjoy what it is, and I love what they created and how they created it. So I'm going to go with 4 mms out of 5. I think regardless of how I feel about like how the story comes together or whatever, it is absolutely fucking incredible to watch. It is beautiful. It is gorgeous. It is every kind of thing I want with like lore filled fantasy stuff. And I think I also, like, every time I've seen it, which is not a lot, to be fair, but I just love how many details you notice. Like, this time I noticed the Skeksis are, like, very, like, female-coded in their weird, like, Victorian gowns that they're wearing, that it looks like they're wearing. And I just, like, there's just, like, so many cool details that go into this movie to make it feel like a world I would love to, like, go play in as a kid. This is the kind of movie, if I had seen it as a kid, I would have made it my entire personality. But Anthony, you have the final word. How many mmms out of five do you give The Dark Crystal?
This is easily a 5 out of 5 for me.
Yeah.
There's nothing I love more than a movie that completely transports you to another world. And I don't know if any movie's ever done it as successfully as this one. Like, my favorite movie of 2023 is Poor Things, because it is like such a different dimension of, yeah, they're in London and we're, you know, whatever, like all these like real locations, but they have such a special flavor to them. Kind of reminds me of like Terry Gilliam, you know, in like Brazil or something like that.
Yeah.
That is just my favorite stuff. And, you know, it's tough to do on the level I'm at, but like that is something like I really strive for. I just want, like, every movie I make, I want to just take place in at least a slightly alternate version of Earth where everything's kind of weird, you know?
Hell yeah.
And this movie just nails it. I feel like I'm on another planet.
Yeah. Yeah. And Poor Things. I love that movie. That movie was one of my favorites from last year. Absolutely. Same. Just the inventiveness on display in that world.
Yeah.
Oh,
it is everything so I've ever wanted.
Yeah.
And it makes me so happy that that movie exists alongside Lisa Frankenstein. Everyone, it is the time of the weird fucked up girl, and it's my favorite.
Oh, I can't wait to see that. Yeah.
Oh. Well, thank you so much, Anthony, for joining us to talk about The Dark Crystal. Are you online? Where can our listeners find you? And the floor is yours to plug away and share what you can talk about.
Yeah, I'm pretty active on Instagram, cousins_Anthony. And there's a Frogman Instagram also, Frogman Movie. So you can follow either of those to get updates on Frogman. It's available March 8th on VOD. Yeah. Hopefully cool. It goes well and we bring Frogman back soon.
Well, and you guys are you guys going to UFF? To Unnamed Footage Festival?
Yes. Yes, we'll be there. Yeah.
So will we.
Oh, hell yeah.
Oh, awesome. Let's hang out. Do you guys like tiki bars?
Yes, I love it. Yes, I love a tiki bar.
Okay, cool. Let's go. I've only ever been to San Francisco once and I wasn't into tiki bars yet. And now I'm like totally obsessed. So I can't wait because I hear they have a good tiki bar game.
Oh, cool.
There's a tiki bar near the theater that's really good too. So we'll have to go enjoy some incredible tropical drinks.
Nice.
At the end of March. Yay. Well, listeners, you've heard from us, but we want to hear from you. What was your experience with The Dark Crystal? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media. I am at MBMcAndrews on Twitter and at MB.McAndrews on Instagram.
And I'm at Gailey Dreadful everywhere.
And of course, don't forget to follow the podcast on social media. We are at Scarred Podcast on Blue Sky and Twitter, and we are at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you everyone for listening. Please stay safe out there. Most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.